Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Today, we have a summary of We Study Billionaires. In this episode, the host delves into the fascinating biography of Warren Buffett, titled Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist by Roger Lowenstein. The discussion highlights how Buffett's early life experiences and unique ventures shaped his character and approach to business, emphasizing the importance of kindness and integrity in achieving success. Get ready to explore the intriguing stories that define one of the world's most renowned investors. Remember to follow us on X and Instagram and on our website, podsummarizer.xyz. And now, let's begin.
So if there's one big takeaway from today's episode, it's to have an excellent understanding that you can succeed in the business world while being someone full of kindness and integrity.
It's a free and easy way to support us, and we'd really appreciate it.
Today, I'm excited to speak about one of my favorite investing biographies, Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist by Roger Lowenstein. I read this book a second time to prepare for this episode, and I must say, it's a very, very well-written biography. Lowenstein does a great job of narrating Buffett's early life and weaving in just some excellent, excellent storytelling along the way. So today, we're going to go into some of the stories that have helped shape Buffett into who he is today, as well as some of the stories that have shaped the public's perception of Warren Buffett. But as with all biographies, we're going to start at the beginning and look at how Buffett's childhood shaped him. Now, Buffett was obsessed with a few things at a very young age that I think are very, very rare. One of his first money-making ventures began just at the age of 6 years old. Now, during that time, he would do things such as buy a six-pack of Coke for 25 cents, sell them each for 5 cents, and then pocket a nickel for himself in profit. He did this for his grandfather's grocery store and even took some time from a rare family vacation in Iowa to sell some Coca-Cola bottles. Now, by the age of 9, Buffett was showing an additional affinity for numbers. Buffett would count bottle caps of different drinks from a nearby gas station with his friend. And it's funny to think about it because this was sort of an entrance into scuttlebutt, which was a type of research that Warren became very well known for. He wasn't just counting all the caps haphazardly. He was doing it with purpose. He was separating them into specific brands. Therefore, you know, he was really examining the microcosm of the competitive landscape of the soft drink industry. And it's funny to think he wouldn't start buying Coca-Cola for nearly five more decades. These idiosyncrasies were just one of many. Buffett also enjoyed thinking about things like memorizing city populations, looking at the frequencies at which individual letters appeared in newspapers, looking at lifespans, and counting how often a ball would bounce off a paddle that he was playing with. One of Buffett's major influences was his father, Howard, whom we'll talk about quite a bit today. One of his first lessons to Warren and his siblings was to understand the value of tangible assets. So when Roosevelt was president, Howard believed that he would destroy the dollar. So he gave the children things like gold coins, and he purchased items such as crystal chandeliers, silver flatware, oriental rugs, and even a farm, all things that are obviously tangible, right? And he did this specifically because he felt that these kinds of items provided good protection against inflation. Now, Howard was a primary influence that sparked Warren's interest in the stock market. Howard worked as a stockbroker for a time, and Warren would visit him at work and spend hours just infatuated with stock and bond certificates. Now, near his father's office was another building that had stock quotations that Warren would frequent. As a result of spending time at his father's office and reading, he got the courage to purchase his first stock at the ripe old age of only 11 years old. Now, the first stock that he ever bought was something called Citi's Preferred Shares. And just to give you an idea of Warren's incredible memory, at the age of 88, he wrote in one Berkshire letter, "The year was 1942. I was 11, and I went all in, investing $114.75 I had begun accumulating at age 6. What I bought was 3 shares of Citi's preferred stock. I had become a capitalist, and it felt good." But, you know, his experience with his first stock investment was probably pretty far from good. So Buffett bought 3 shares for himself and 3 for his sister at around $38. After purchasing, the share price plummeted to $27, which obviously caused a lot of concern for both Warren Buffett and his sister, Doris. Warren ended up holding and selling for a small profit when the stock price went back up to $40. Unfortunately, the stock price continued to rise to about $200, leaving Warren with his first major lesson regarding the mistake of omission, which is to sell too early. Warren was more skewed towards learning about business the old-fashioned way. He had a slew of different money-making activities in his teenage years, helping him understand how business was conducted and run. So a couple of the different ventures he had, you know, he would go around golf courses, find golf balls, then resell them to other golfers. He built a small paper delivery empire, delivering about 500 newspapers daily and netting himself about $175 a month. He even bought farmland. He rented a car that him and a friend restored and made income that way. And perhaps my favorite story was just the pinball business. So a friend of Warren's, Donald Danley, bought a pinball machine in the senior year of high school. Now, picture an adolescent Warren and his friend Danley playing pinball in the basement, frustrated that the machine would just continue breaking down. Now, luckily for Warren, Danley had expertise in fixing the device each time that it broke down. This got Warren thinking, what if they put a pinball machine in a local barbershop and rented it out? Dan could handle any of the needed maintenance. So Warren and Donald approached a barber who agreed to have a machine in his shop with a 50-50 split. And at the end of the first day, Warren and Donald found $14 in the machine. Warren's eyes lit up as he calculated the potential profits from this business venture. That taste of success led him to continue pressing on. Within a month, their pinball machines were in three more stores. That led to continued growth into even more barbershops. They eventually called the business Wilson Coin Operated Machine Company, and they were making about $50 a week. Warren's part of the business was to buy the pinball machines for about $25 to $75 and write regular financial statements. Donald Danley would fix them, and that was just the business model. However, since Warren and Donald were only in high school at the time, they had to invent a story that they actually worked for someone else, which they obviously found very, very amusing. Now, I like the story because it's just so easy to relate to. When I was in Omaha this past May to see Warren at his final Berkshire Annual General Meeting, we got a chance to go to one of his favorite stores, which is Hollywood Candy. Now, if you want to understand what Hollywood Candy's like, picture your favorite candy store, then quadruple its size, and you're probably going to be in the right neighborhood. There's even a video floating around on the internet of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates walking through the store. It's very wholesome, and they have a little shrine to it inside of the store. One part of the book that I found fascinating and telling of Warren's future abilities as a father and a husband was his relationship with his mother. It was rocky, to say the least. Warren's mother, Layla, was a sweet-natured woman, but she could turn on a dime. Without any warning, she could become just furious. She'd rage at Warren and his sisters for hours at a time. She would compare them to other children, criticize their every single behavior, and bring up their failings. From the sounds of it, these mood changes were completely unpredictable, which made them all the more shocking to Buffett and his sisters. Concerning this, Lowenstein writes, "Once, in more recent years, one of Warren's sons, who was home from college, called Layla to say hello. She suddenly lit into him with all her fury. She called him a terrible person for not calling and detailed his supposedly innumerable failings of character. And this went on for about 2 hours. When Warren's son put down the phone, he was in tears. Warren said softly, "Now you know how I felt every day of my life." I think this likely would be considered a pretty traumatic event for Warren. And it's hard to assume just how much of an impact it's had on him for his entire life. But it's hard to imagine it hasn't had some sort of effect on him, especially as a father. Perhaps his distance from his children was born out of a fear that he would have some of his mother's fury inside of him as well. We'll never know for sure. And then in terms of ambition, perhaps some of his ambition came from wanting to show his mother that he had more value than she was attributing to him. This is all speculation, of course. Warren is an intensely private person, but it's hard not to see how events like this could have shaped him for better or worse into the person that he is today. Let's now chat about another one of Buffett's biggest inspirations, Benjamin Graham. Buffett went to Columbia to take Graham's course on investing. This was about a year after The Intelligent Investor, Graham's most well-known book, was released.
Having delved into the complexities of Warren's upbringing and its potential influences, the narrative shifts towards his early career, where we uncover the pivotal moments that shaped his investment philosophy under Benjamin Graham.
But by 1954, the religious barrier on Wall Street had been dropped. And as a result, Graham offered Buffett a job paying him about $12,000 a year. And while Buffett must have felt like this job was a dream come true, as time passed, he realized the job at Graham Newman wasn't really the best fit for him. For one thing, Buffett felt Graham was overly fearful of another depression. This made getting ideas that Warren had really hard to get approved. And Warren had tons of ideas at this time. Additionally, the firm had managed very small amounts of capital, approximately $12 million. And much of this capital was tied up in cash, which was presumably because Graham was fearful of deploying this cash in case of another depression. Another problem was Graham's obsession with the company's balance sheet. For instance, Walter Schloss bought Haloid, which owned Xerox, to Graham. Haloid's current business was worth about $17, but the stock traded for $21. Schloss concluded that you could take a flyer on Xerox for $4 and see what would happen with a fair amount of downside protection. But Graham told Schloss it just wasn't cheap enough. To Graham, Haloid was just pure speculation. Now, by 1956, Graham actually shut down Graham Newman. And during this time, Warren had been very busy building his personal account. When Warren talks about the legendary times of compounding over 50% per annum, it was during this exact period that he was referring to. Between 1950, when he'd finished college, and 1956, when Graham Newman was shut down, Buffett compounded his personal account at 56% per annum. And this is where the story of Buffett just really takes off. In 1956, Buffett began accepting money from family and friends and established partnerships with them. Buffett was 26 years old at this time. And even at this young age, he faced problems that most 26-year-olds today don't spend much time thinking about. And that's the problem of legacy. We know Buffett loved math and the concepts of compounding. You know, he just finished this period of his life where he was compounding at 56%. While he would have known that he probably would not have kept that rate of return up forever, he knew that even if he made half that return for another decade or so, he would be worth millions of dollars. Buffett thought this was a foregone conclusion, and he worried about what all that money would do for his kids. This is a great example of Warren being rational and wanting to give his kids just a good life while making sure they didn't grow up with a silver spoon. Now let's get back to how the partnerships were formatted at this time. Buffett has made the 0-6-25 free structure very popular among Buffett clones such as Monish Pabrai or Gautam Baid. But his original format was actually a little bit more favorable for Buffett. So he started actually at 0-4-25. Now I have no idea why it started at 4% and then moved to 6%. I can only guess here, and my guess is that Buffett might have needed more money when he first started the fund, and having that 4% watermark allowed him to make a few extra bucks while still offering a great return to his partners. Once he was more established and had more capital, he probably raised it because his needs changed as the partnership scaled up. By the end of 1957, about 2 years after leaving Graham and Newman, Buffett had managed 5 separate accounts. The combined capital was very modest at just $500,000. And in that year, he posted returns of about 10% compared to the Dow's return of negative 8%. You might be looking at this number and thinking, okay, well, it's not that impressive. But given the down year in the index, the impressive part about his performance was the 18 percentage points of outperformance. In Lowenstein's book, instead, we can examine his partnership letters from those days to see how he wanted to be evaluated. And it's quite simple. He wanted to beat the Dow, or more like cream the Dow, by 10 percentage points per year. If you want to learn more about Buffett's ground rules for how he managed the partnership during that time, I would recommend listening to TIP 662, where I go in depth into this subject. The point here is that Warren thought a good investor should be able to beat a benchmark. Otherwise, what was the point in putting your money in with that investor? Now back to the partnership. So the partnership years were also a time when Warren remained focused on his lessons from Ben Graham. If you made 56% returns per annum, I think you'd probably stick to the same strategy as well. So he was looking at just a ton of cheap companies. One interesting idiosyncrasy about Warren was that he did not like to share his ideas with others. And I think he did this for a few reasons. First, he believed in the independence of thought. And I think if he thought that he should have independence of thought, it was probably logical that he would think that others should as well. And second, he knew a lot of people who highly respected his opinions on investing and had substantial financial resources. So when you're looking at microcaps, which was what Warren was doing at this time with, you know, small floats, low liquidity, the last thing you want is competition for shares. From 1957 to 1961, Buffett had cumulative gains of 251% for the partnership compared to just 74% for the Dow. This single partnership allowed him to quadruple the minimum investment to about $100,000. Another significant event occurred during this time. Warren was introduced to Charlie Munger. And, you know, they hit it off immediately. And Munger helped change some of Warren's thinking about the role of quality in investing. Around the time that Warren met Charlie, he'd invested in a cigar butt called Dempster Mill Manufacturing. It was, you know, your typical Graham play. Cheap, tons of assets. But similar to many Graham-type businesses, the actual business was just nothing to brag about. Warren thought the shares were cheap enough to take a controlling interest. But when he went to the mill to see why it just wasn't performing very well, he knew he didn't have the skill set to right that ship. So Warren went to Charlie about the problem with Dempster. Charlie had a different thought process on businesses like Dempster than Graham would have offered. Charlie felt that troubled companies like Dempster traded at discounts because the underlying business just wasn't good. And it was also hard to fix these types of businesses. Now, luckily for Warren, Charlie introduced him to his friend, Harry Bottle. Harry went into the business and just cleaned house. He decreased inventory and staff count, and it worked wonders from a financial standpoint. One interesting aspect of the dumpster story was how Harry went about decreasing inventory levels. Harry attributes a significant portion of the success of this specifically to Warren and Charlie. And interestingly, they were able to increase the value of inventory by assessing its replacement cost against those of competitors. Here's what Harry said. One idea came from Warren and Charlie. Upon investigating our sales pricing structure, we were evaluating replacement and repair parts equal to the total of the sum of the completed item. So, lacking of any cost data to determine the correct pricing, they suggested that we simply categorize all parts into three categories. The first one, an item 100% proprietary, not available except from us, increase up to 500%. An item semi-proprietary, increase 200 to 300%. Non-proprietary, increase 0 to 100%. We turned this inventory with an estimated inventory value of $300,000 into a resale value exceeding $2 million. Incidentally, we had a few, if any, objections to our pricing strategy and continued to sell these parts at higher sales prices with little, if any, sales resistance. Now, this clearly showed Warren that a business that could increase the price of its products was a very, very powerful business model. And even though Dempster wasn't a great business, it was a crucial lesson that Warren would utilize for future investments. But as I mentioned there previously, Bottle had to lay people off, and laying people off did not sit well with Warren, and he never wanted to go through that type of experience again. So, you know, Warren wasn't perfect. Despite this crucial lesson that he learned at Dempster, he was about to make arguably the worst investment decision of his career. And this, of course, was his investment into Berkshire Hathaway. Funny enough, when doing some of the scuttlebutt on this industry, he would have learned that textiles was a really lousy business.
Having navigated the complexities of Warren's early lessons in business, the narrative shifts towards his tumultuous journey with Berkshire Hathaway, revealing the challenges he faced amidst a shifting market landscape.
You don't know in the end whether you've won or lost. Now, getting back to investing, Warren stayed very busy in 1973. This was a period when the Nifty 50 was beginning to crack and fund managers were pulling money out of the market as fear crept up. During this time, Buffett made several investments in Berkshire Hathaway. So they were names such as Detroit International Bridge, National Presto Industries, Dean Witter, Ford Motor, Pick and Save, Grand Union, and many other names were being added to Berkshire's public stock portfolio. Conditions were so good for Buffett that he had more ideas than cash at this time. Now, to solve this, he wanted to raise about $20 million in senior notes. The problem was that raising this money was actually pretty tough because lenders knew that Berkshire, the textile mill, was not a good business and wouldn't want to put money into that business. So Solomon Brothers, who was in charge of helping to raise the money, had to actually persuade the lenders that the money was specifically for Buffett and not to reinvest into Berkshire Hathaway. Lenders also demanded in the terms that they'd be able to demand repayment if Warren Buffett sold stock. Warren eventually secured the $20 million at about an 8% interest rate. Warren made a good point that borrowing money makes the most sense when the money is cheap. This reminds me of debt cycles that Howard Marks has discussed in details in The Most Important Thing. Debt is cheapest when lenders are willing to lend. If you wait to borrow when you need a loan, you're likely going to get worse terms on that debt. This is a good lesson regarding raising capital. Now, in 1974, Warren discovered other business models that he was starting to find attractive. Media businesses was one of them. He saw media businesses as a cash-generating machine due to their ability to generate revenue through advertising. And, you know, unlike, say, a Dempster Mill or Berkshire, which just sucked up cash to make profits, an advertising business required a couple of people, some desks, and a pencil to generate advertising profits. This was the kind of business that Warren really, really liked. Given his success with other media businesses, it's clear that he nailed this business model. I also personally like this business model, not necessarily in advertising, but just broadly. So bear with me here. So I owned a coal royalty business, and this was a similar business model in my opinion. Now, it seems a little bit weird, but let me explain. So if we look at Buffett, he knew that advertisers needed a place to advertise. When Buffett made these investments, the primary means of advertising was through things like TV, newspapers, and radio. So if you owned a business in that industry, that was your key to success. Now, as for the coal royalty business that I owned, the world still needs coal, especially the kind that's used for making steel. There are only certain places where metallurgical coal is located. So if you own the land where that coal sits, you could generate loads of cash without spending very much money, as the miner actually takes care of the capex in this case. And that's what this business does. It's got 50 employees and generates a few hundred million in annual revenue. Pretty good. Now, during 1974, the market completely collapsed. The market had been in a bear market for about 6 years, twice as long as the bear market that was caused by the Great Depression. And at this time, Warren was as happy as he could be. In a rare public interview on Forbes, Buffett was quoted as saying, "Now is the time to invest and get rich." And since he truly believed this, unlike many other fund managers, he made just an absolute killing.
Hey everybody, it's Clay Fink here, host of We Study Billionaires. We host weekly live Zoom discussions that feature Q&As with podcast guests, social hours with TIB hosts, stock presentations, and member spotlights, as spots are limited. Simply go to theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind to join the waitlist to apply. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. If you enjoy excellent breakdowns on individual stocks, then you need to check out The Intrinsic Value Podcast, hosted by Sean O'Malley and Daniel Manka. Each week, Sean and Daniel do in-depth analysis on a company's business model and competitive advantages, and in real time, they build out the intrinsic value portfolio for you to follow along as they search for value in the market. So far, they've done analysis on great businesses like John Deere, Ulta Beauty, AutoZone, and Airbnb, and I recommend starting with the episode on Nintendo, the global powerhouse in gaming. It's rare to find a show that consistently publishes high-quality, comprehensive deep dives that cover all of the aspects of a business from an investment perspective. Go follow The Intrinsic Value Podcast on your favorite podcasting app and discover the next stock to add to your portfolio or watch list.
Another business that Warren is very well known for is Blue Chip Stamps. This business had a float similar to an insurance company. And as we already know, Buffett loved businesses that generated cash that he could invest in opportunities with superior returns. Lowenstein writes, "To Buffett, Blue Chip was simply an insurance company that wasn't regulated." Now here's how it works. So Blue Chip collected a fee from supermarkets that distributed its trading stamps and redeemed these stamps for free items such as, you know, toasters or lawn chairs. It was selling about $120 million of stamps to retailers each year. And since the owners of the stamps wouldn't redeem them immediately, it meant that there was ample amounts of cash in the business that could be redeployed elsewhere. Now, even though Blue Chip Stamps was a good business, it ended up being a pretty big headache for both Buffett and Munger. So there was some complicated ownership structure that would end up biting them both in the butt. So Buffett owned Blue Chip Stamps through three separate vehicles. He and his wife owned it personally. Berkshire Hathaway owned it, and Diversified Retailing, a partnership with Charlie Munger, owned a slice as well. Then with Blue Chip Stamps also investing into public businesses, regulators just saw this as a massive conflict of interest. So the problem really arose due to a business called Wesco. So Wesco was a savings and loan business that was undervalued, trading at around half its book value. So Blue Chip quickly bought up about 8% of the company. Eventually, Wesco announced a plan to merge with another savings and loan business called Santa Barbara. But this merger just didn't sit well with either Buffett or Munger, because they saw it as Wesco shareholders exchanging their undervalued shares for expensive shares of Santa Barbara. As a side note, I don't mind these types of transactions if you own the more expensive business. And the reason is simple. So there's an arbitrage opportunity when an expensive company acquires a cheap one. For instance, if your company trades at 30 times earnings, and you buy a company at 5 times earnings, it re-rates once it becomes part of that parent company to 30 times. So if you buy it for $5 million, meaning it has $1 million in earnings, once you own it, it's now worth $30 million based on the multiple.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram and visit our website podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.